Welcome to the second Market Dojo Procurement Podcast. I'm Peter Smith, and I'm joined by Alan Rafiq and Nick Drew from the procurement technology firm Market Dojo. Hi, guys.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
So our core topic today is change management, with both some general thoughts and also more specific comments on how that relates to procurement technology. But before we get into that, here are our procurement news headlines. Over to you, Alan.
Oh, thanks, Peter. So the global trade wars continue. Most people are expecting the US and China to have come to some agreement by now, but President Trump upped the stakes instead, slapping bigger tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese exports. It's hard to see where all this goes from here, but procurement people whose businesses involve international trade need to stay very close to this, obviously. But is it leading to major changes in sourcing strategies yet? Well, there is some evidence that firms are looking for more local approaches to provide protection against various global uncertainties. But we've had 30 years at least of global and low-cost country sourcing, so it won't all get unraveled overnight.
No, interesting times, and more power to the procurement function, perhaps, with all this going on. And closer to home with the function, the SIPS Hays Procurement Salary Guide is now out and available from the Hays website. It's based on a survey of around 3,000 people and is useful to organizations and, of course, to individual procurement professionals as well. I did find the way some of the data is presented a little confusing. For instance, average salary increases are quoted for those people who received an increase. So we're left wondering how many didn't get any increase. Hence, the overall figure quoted is 5.3%, but this seems to be those who got an increase got 5.3% on average, if you see what I mean. It looks pretty healthy generally for the profession, though, and the public sector appears to have caught up a bit on the private sector in the last year in terms of salary, which is interesting. And the gender pay gap issue is a little mixed. So at the very top, it widened a little, whereas at more junior levels, it narrowed. So I guess you're looking in a somewhat different market, Alan and Nick, but what do you see as a firm that's been recruiting quite actively in recent times?
Well, I've been recruiting quite a lot in the sales function at the moment. About 10 or so people have been joining our team recently. And one thing I've really noticed, graduates are coming out with some very high expectations as to what an initial salary should be. Certainly, back in my day, I would be dreaming of such a salary to get on my first job. But equally, what I've noticed, and tying in with the 5.3% in procurement, in sales, I have to deal with somewhat more elevated salary increases. I guess part and parcel of that function is that people can create quite compelling pitches as to why they deserve far more salary. Yeah. So I have quite a battle to contend with each time.
Yeah, they take it a very logical case studies there. And one of the other challenges is not so much the gender pay gap, but the gender gap. So we don't look like a stag do when we're out on a business do. But that's maybe another topic.
So there's a message there. If you're a ambitious, successful young saleswoman, there may be jobs for you with Market Dojo. Okay, back to the news and back to you, Nick.
Thanks. Well, the Brexit ferry contract, it's the story that just keeps on giving. The UK Departments for Transport awarded contracts to three firms for emergency cross-channel transport in the event of a no-deal Brexit. It turned out that one firm, Seabourn, didn't even have any ships or agreement as to where it could sail them from. So that was a bit embarrassing. But then Eurotunnel sued the government because they were not involved in the original contracting process. As a result, the government paid them off with a bung of £33 million. And now P&O Ferries are complaining about that payment and suing the government themselves. The firm says the payment to Eurotunnel is in effect illegal state aid and helps their biggest competitor. Of course, in normal times, the minister involved, Chris Grayling, would have been fired by now. But in these weird Brexit days, that just hasn't happened.
And I suppose we should be grateful he's not standing for leader of the Tory party and prime minister. He was also responsible, of course, for the disastrous privatisation of probation services in 2014 when he was Justice Secretary, an experiment that's now been pretty much abandoned after pretty much total failure. And it was announced recently that the contracts with private providers won't be recompeted and the work will largely come back in-house. I've spoken to a couple of people who worked with Grayling when they were civil servants, and they say he's not a bad bloke. His record of ministerial failure really is quite impressive now. Back to you, Alan.
Very impressive indeed, but not the kind you want on your CV, I guess.
No.
We've seen a couple of interesting fraud stories in the press too, both with a procurement angle. Carlos Ghosn, the ex-head of Nissan and Renault-Nissan joint venture, is being investigated by both firms. There are accusations of inappropriate spending, including consultancy payments made to former French Justice Minister Rachida Dati. At the other extreme of global significance, the Cambridge head teacher hit the headlines recently. James Stewart was found guilty back in 2017 of stealing school funds, but has just recently been struck off as a teacher. His inappropriate procurement spending was used to set up what the Sun newspaper described as a sex lair within his office, which he filled with sex toys and booze. The sex den was only uncovered when a roofing contractor spotted a large purple item, let's say, through the office skylight.
Interesting. So my office is at home, so I guess I'd have to get planning permission to turn it into a sex lair, but I'm sure Surrey Heath Council wouldn't mind. My wife might, of course, but
And on the other hand, if you think about it, there must actually be a procurement person out there who is responsible for buying these items daily, perhaps.
Indeed, yes, and I'm just thinking this is probably the first ever procurement podcast where the words sex lair have been used. So I think it's a Guinness Book of Records moment, I think. Okay, back to reality, I think. That's all the news for now. Let's move on to our main theme for today, change management, with a particular focus on procurement, of course. I'm going to be discussing that with Alan and Nick in a couple of minutes. But first, a few thoughts, not from me personally, but from a 16th century Italian diplomat and writer. Now, Niccolò Machiavelli's name has become synonymous with treachery and deceit. We talk about Machiavellian plots in politics, for instance. But really, he was way ahead of his time in analysing difficult issues that apply to managers and businesses today, as well as they applied to rulers of Italian cities and states in the early 1500s. And he was certainly perceptive about the challenges of change management. Here's a direct quote from his masterwork, The Prince. "And let it be noted that there is no more delicate matter to take in hand, nor more dangerous to conduct, nor more doubtful in its success than to set up as a leader in the introduction of changes." And he goes on to explain why change is so difficult to implement. Those who are likely to benefit from a change tend to keep a fairly low profile. They don't want to upset the potential losers, and they may well have reasonable doubts themselves about the change until they really see it happening. But those who oppose the change for whatever reason tend to do so much more loudly and actively. Back to Machiavelli. Hence it is that whenever the opponents of the new order of things have the opportunity to attack it, they will do it with the zeal of partisans, whilst the others defend it but feebly, so that it is dangerous to rely upon the latter. So we must realize that people achieve their own influence and power from the structures, processes and organizations that are currently in place. If you challenge those, then they will respond defensively. And moving into more modern psychological ideas, they may move into a fight or flight mode, the way we respond to physical threats. Now, you may say, well, I'm only trying to introduce a new purchase to pay system, or we're only looking at a new category management process. But to some people, this may be a risk. What if I'm not smart enough to operate the new system? What if the category management process means I have to stop using my tried and tested suppliers, who also take me out for nice lunches? What if I'm no longer seen as the experienced expert by my colleagues? So how do we manage this? There's no magic answer, of course, but good communication, giving people reassurance about issues such as training, finding ways in which people can contribute themselves to the shape of the change program. These approaches and others can help. But one other point Machiavelli makes is also relevant, and I'll pick this up with Alan in a moment. He, that's Niccolo, not Alan, suggests that rulers should aim to be both loved and feared. However, he says that is often difficult. So if you have to choose, which is it to be? Here's his quote. One would like to be both one and the other, but because it is difficult to combine them, it is far better to be feared than loved if you cannot be both. To be clear, he's not saying that being feared is somehow better than being loved, which is how this is sometimes described. But he is saying that if you can't have both, you'll be a more successful ruler with fear. Now, these days, I think perhaps we might substitute the word respect for fear in the modern business context. But this is very relevant for change management. If the person trying to drive change is not respected, if people think they may not be backed by their superiors or that the change might come to nothing, then those who think they might lose out will push back harder. Put it another way, any manager trying to drive significant change needs to make sure they have the backing for it from those who matter in the organization. So let's open up the debate now with Alan and Nick. And Alan, when we touched on this earlier, and you have some pretty strong views on this sort of respect issue, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting to look at where firms have come from and analogies to various other departments. I mean, when firms are growing, they generally always have a sales department and a finance department, which need to report to the various management positions to be able to run the business. And to do that reporting, they need finance systems and CRM systems. And salespeople and finance people use these systems. They're when they start in organizations, they're kind of told to use them. And no one uses the word mandated, but that's exactly what they are. In procurement seems to have less visibility at a higher level and a reluctance to mandate their systems. So when a new person starts in procurement, it seems to be, here's the email, here's your spreadsheets, but very rarely do you kind of hear, and here's the system which you have to use for something, for e-sourcing and supplier engagement, for example. And you know, you're going to look at what's the cost of not adopting these systems that are paid for, and you know, have a significant cost in terms of the implementation sometimes, or in deciding the new processes.
Interesting. Do you think that's because procurement leaders, senior people, want to be loved, that they're worried about being seen as dictatorial by pushing these things, or is it that they don't have the respect of their team? Why is this happening?
Oh, it's really interesting. I mean, I think sometimes there's a challenge with the word mandate. Everyone thinks, well, we don't want to mandate it. We want, you know, bring everyone on board on a kind of a because it's all wonderful to use. But I think that's some of the challenge. Also, with the, you know, is procurement at the high enough level within organisations? I wouldn't necessarily they want to be loved, but I think there may be more hopeful that things are going to change when that change. You know, if you look at all the implementations in the past, it hasn't really driven that change.
Well, it's also interesting. By the CPO or head of procurement not backing their own decision, it reveals some perhaps underlying doubt in what they're doing. They haven't quite got that conviction that their strategy is the best approach. Like when a new CEO joins a company, they will set the vision, set the strategy, and everything in the business is 100% to be focused on that strategy. If they have to sack the rest of the executive board, they will. You know, they'll move mountains to embed that strategy. And yet we don't really see that so much in the procurement world. It's more, well, let's just see how we get on and we'll make some improvements from there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember a few years ago, I was talking to a lady I know who was head of procurement technology for a very big company, you know, UK top 30 company. And I asked her what their sourcing technology was. I think it might have been more than just sourcing, it might have been analytics and stuff as well. And she told me it was one of the big suites. And I said, so what have you done with it in the year or so since you implemented it? And she said, oh, we've run two auctions. And I was waiting for her to go on and tell me all the other things they'd done. And she just stopped. And I said, and what else? She said, no, that's it. We've run two auctions. And they must have spent, you know, comfortably a six-figure sum, maybe even seven figures, on this. And I couldn't get to the bottom of, well, just as you say, Nick, was it a lack of confidence in their own decision? Was it the CPO didn't feel they had the power to insist people use it? What was it? But it was just a huge waste of money. So anyway, I guess you two often see change from the perspective of clients bringing in your sourcing technology for the first time. Is that usually a change in its own right, or is it often part of a wider procurement transformation program or something like that?
It's in our case often a bit of both, really. The small change then goes on to fuel the transformation. For example, one client we work with in the construction sector, they used our on-demand model at Market Dojo for just running a single auction. And after a fantastic result, it propelled them to prepare a business case, go to the board and really flesh out what a full-on e-procurement transformation could generate for the organization. And so this kind of toe-in-the-water approach really gave the procurement team the perfect motivation and business case for permanent change, one that was already cash flow positive from the results of the auction.
Interesting. So apart from the fear thing, you know, terrifying everybody, any other tips about how else you can build the enthusiasm for change, particularly if it involves new technology?
Well, in technology, the obvious answer is to make the technology genuinely enjoyable to use and effective for what they're trying to accomplish. But going beyond that, you know, clients often use the carrot approach of elevating individual results, promoting them in the organization, generating leaderboards. It's quite similar, you know, back to Alan's analogy in the sales world there, of promoting success. And so that sort of generates self-interest from people. We also see that you can build your procurement process within the technology. That's what people do with us. And so then users have to think less and do less. It's all the technology is doing it for them. In other words, you know, directly tackling that key objection that we see of, you know, what's in it for me, it answers that.
Which I guess goes back to Machiavelli's views on people being worried about change and seeing it as a negative for them. That they can be the people who push back the hardest. Yeah. Something I've seen, it comes back perhaps to the point you made a minute ago about getting those early benefits. So I've worked a couple of times with a guy called George Owens, who won the SIPS European Procurement Professional of the Year Award in 2017, I think. And I've seen George drive significant procurement transformation programs in a couple of big organizations very successfully. He's a program manager by background as much as he is a procurement specialist. And he's very much into detailed planning and a program management approach. He's great at getting senior management buy-in. So these are very, very big, complex programs. But he does also focus on those quick wins. So he's not someone who goes to the board and says, this is going to take us 3 years and cost us X million pounds, and at the end of it, you'll see all these benefits. He's very focused on getting some quick wins so that you can see the success and build on the success, and you take your own people and the stakeholders and the top team with you. So I think that is critical. What about the dark side of all this in terms of change management? What about the don'ts and the negatives? Anything we haven't touched on already?
And there's a few things I could think of there on the do's. If you're going to make the change, you know, make the change. I mean, I don't consider myself a Luddite as a co-founder of a technology company. At least I hope I'm not. But our CRM system, they had an interface update a few years back. And I was the last person to adopt the change. In fact, I didn't adopt it till I was forced to, because it just changed. And for a month, I was like, oh, this is not as good interface as the last one. I don't know where to find things. 2 months later, I can't remember what the old interface was. It's absolutely fine, the new interface. And change is always difficult, I find. But you find if you can drive through that change it quickly, it might be a short gap of like pain, and then no one knows the difference. And if you draw the analogy to procurement software, then if you irk these things out over months and years, how much money you might lose. I do remember one company that hadn't got the ROI from their e-sourcing system, so we pitched them for the next year, and they said, well no, we're going to use the system again for another year to try and get an ROI. I don't think you want to flog a dead horse in that and the other ones on don'ts is it's nice to have a big vision of change, but don't try and do it all at once. Try to get the quick wins first.
Well, absolutely, and it's interesting your friend there in the procurement space, Peter, was doing that, and certainly for terrible reasons that I won't go into, is we've certainly seen in the press certain ERP implementations that have gone pretty badly wrong. I know there was one not so long ago from a leading discount retailer that resulted in their 500 million euro bill for a failed ERP. I won't name any names. They've got far bigger legal budget than they do. But it's certainly, there's some lessons learned from these kind of trying the big bang approach.
Indeed. So one other point around that, over the years, I've become more and more enthusiastic about the concept of having clear procurement target operating models. And often that's a result of the change program. So clear statements about just how procurement should work. And do you see that becoming more common? Are you seeing people putting in target operating models and talking about that concept?
Well, not in those precise words, perhaps. But if you see that the target operating model is basically turning the procurement strategy into daily operation, it uses those three key pillars of people, process, and technology. And looking at some newly appointed procurement directors or CPOs that we work with, they really wish to imprint their signature really across the organization by adapting what they've seen as the current operating model and turning it into their vision, their target that the rest of the team can get behind. Now, how well that has actually been documented and implemented is a very separate question. Mm. But certainly we have seen that kind of culture, I guess, when new people start the role.
Which I think also there's an issue. We've talked about compliance a couple of times and people just not doing what they should be doing, frankly. But I think if you don't document it, as you just said, if you don't have that clarity of these are the target models, the target processes, then it's very easy for people to say, oh, well, I didn't know I should be doing that. Nobody told me. It's not written down anywhere. And I've seen that as a failing actually quite recently in a bit of work I did. So anyway, I hope that was interesting. We've run out of time. So thanks to Alan and Nick for their contribution today. Thanks to Market Dojo generally for developing this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it and got something useful out of it. And we hope to be back with more shortly. So that's goodbye from me and goodbye from Alan.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And thanks very much for listening.